Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sparks fly in Israel this week and over the High Court and earmarks and more. Then there's Jihad Jane. Vice President Joe Biden arrives in Israel to boost peace talks and is smacked with an Israeli decision to push new housing into East Jerusalem. His response was sharp.
As we move forward, the United States will hold both sides accountable for any statements or actions that inflame tensions or prejudice the outcome of talks, as this decision did.
Chief Justice John Roberts goes public with umbrage over President Obama's criticism of a court decision in his State of the Union address.
It does cause you to think whether or not it makes sense for us to be there. To the extent the State of the Union has degenerated into a political pep rally, I'm not sure why we're there.
And Pennsylvania woman Colleen LaRose, a.k.a. Jihad Jane, is indicted for taking part in a plot to kill a Swedish cartoonist who mocked Muhammad. CBS News' Bob Orr lays it out.
This federal indictment cites an email from LaRose pledging to kill her target. I will make this my goal, Jihad Jane wrote, till I achieve it or die trying.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What do you make of sparks in Israel, Obama at home, Jihad Jane? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from the Capitol in Washington is Andrea Seabrook, congressional correspondent for National Public Radio. Andrea, welcome back to One Point. Great to have you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Also with us from New York is George Packer, Bigfoot journalist and staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He has a big piece in the current issue, Obama's Lost Year. His most recent book is Interesting Times, Writings from a Turbulent Decade. George Packer, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Andrea, and George.
Andrea, I feel like we've started with this one for weeks in a row now. Every Friday we're asking about health care, but here we are one more time. Let's listen to the president. Here he is stumping for health care reform yet again, once more with feeling at a high school in St. Charles, Missouri on Wednesday.
The American people will be more secure with this reform. Our country will be stronger because of this reform. I don't know about the politics, but I know it is the right thing to do. And that's why I'm fighting so hard to get it done.
And will he be worn down? No, says the president.
I don't get worn down. I wear them down. I don't get worn down.
Okay, and now, Andrea, we learned this morning he's putting off his trip to Indonesia, Guam, Australia, to be around a few more days for health. What's happening on the health reform front, Andrea?
Well, you know, it sure seems as if the president has really steeled his stance about health care. You know, there were a couple of times during this now more than a year-long debate here in the Capitol where it seemed like the energy faltered, most recently with the Massachusetts Senate race and, you know, a Republican in Ted Kennedy's
seat. Scott Brown's election there, right.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so it really seems like in these last couple of days, though, that he has really steeled his resolve, and he's giving these speeches that I think matter. I think it matters when 535, actually more like 532 at this point, members of Congress and senators are in their offices watching the same speeches on the news networks and on C-SPAN, seeing his face as he makes this argument again and again. I think it matters. And, you know, here at the Capitol, there are some procedural problems, but, you know, procedure really never stopped anything that was, you know, destined to happen. And I think that at this point, signs point to yes. It looks like here in the House that lawmakers are weighing the idea of going home to campaign for reelection, having done nothing and saying they stopped something that would have been terrible, or having done something and saying, it's not perfect, but I did something. So, you know, there's that going on here.
Destined to happen. That's a phrase we haven't heard attached to health care reform for a while. George Packer, your piece this week, you know, is talking about the Obama's lost year. Is he back? Is this just a couple of good speeches and same old, same old? Do you see something new going on here, George?
I do see something a little bit new. I think that the long quest for bipartisanship on the president's part seems to be over. That healthcare summit the other week had to have brought him the news that there was simply was no negotiating partner on the other side, which was pretty clear by late last summer. But I think this meant so much to Obama, his mission to cleanse our politics, which covers everything from campaign finance, which I guess we'll talk about later,
yes,
to civility and the way you deal with the opposition. He simply didn't have anyone on the other side who really wanted to meet him halfway. And so he seems to have given up on that and instead is firing up his troops and even trying to reactivate the movement that helped get him elected by really putting pressure on his grassroots support, who've been pretty dormant for the past year, to start heating up the pressure on their own representatives. So I think it may well be that, at least for now, he has backed off one of the major things that brought him to the presidency, which is the sense that we could move beyond 30 or 40 years of acrimonious and petty partisanship. And instead, he's decided the content of this bill, the substance of health care, my presidency are on the line here. And that those will have to come before the ongoing effort to incorporate Republicans into it. I think the White House is the last place in this country that continue to believe that bipartisanship in the past year was possible.
A long round trip to the position he opened wanting to fight to the polarization. Jack Beatty there. Democrats are rolling student loan reforms into the health care package or looking at trying to.
Very important. That looked like that might actually die in the Senate because six conservative Democrats were getting cold feet about it. Sallie Mae, the big banking combine, was spending millions on the Hill lobbying. It looked like that could actually die in the Senate. And this will mean it could pass if it went in with through reconciliation with 51 votes. So that salts it for the House. On the other hand, there's a sour note for the House, too, today. The Senate parliamentarian has ruled that the president has to sign the Senate bill before it can go back to the Senate for reconciliation. That really puts House members on the spot. A bill to which they passionately object, many of them, for all the reasons we know, the Cornhusker provision, the Louisiana Purchase, and the rest. The president is going to sign into law, and they have to take it on faith that the Senate will be able to get it through. And their faith in the Senate has been worn down this past year. So that makes it a tougher vote. You know, finally, it comes down to those 39 Democrats who voted against it, 31 from districts carried by McCain. It comes down to people like, Colin Peterson of Minnesota. He carried his seat by 45 points. McCain carried the district by 3. Is Colin taking a risk by voting for this? How about Tim Holden in Pennsylvania? He carried his district by 27, McCain by 3. Is Tim taking a big chance?
I'm sure they're reading the tea leaves out there, Jack.
Yeah, I know. I know.
It's their political careers. You know, speaking of the Senate, Andrea, we had movement on earmarks in the House. Interesting sort of different directions of movement, but not in the Senate. Lay out for us, if you would, what have the Democrats done here on earmarks in the House? What do the Republicans do? Which is for real either?
Oh, my goodness. You know, those are all of the questions that we're all looking at right now. You know, the House leadership has done some other things on earmarks since they came into the leadership in 2006 and again in 2008 with the election of President Obama. There have been some changes. Now, this is one thing that it seems to be the real deal is the House Democratic leadership's resolve, at least for now, to ban all private company for-profit earmarks. Now, this is the worst offender of earmarks. This is what gives them the terrible name that they have, because a lawmaker in Committee X can go in and secure an earmark for a private company that turns around, that private company gets all that money from the government, turns around and donates money to the campaign.
That sounds like a pretty big step. Am I wrong? Is that not a big portion of earmarks?
It's not necessarily a big portion, but it's the worst offender. Mm-hmm. So that's important. Now, remember, the Senate is a different whole beast over there, and they have made nary a squeak about whether or not they would do this. And so you might come down to a situation where the Democrats get rid of these kinds of earmarks out of their bills, the senators don't, and you have to see how a bill is going to pass. Bills have to be exactly the same in the House and the Senate for them to be signed into law.
What
and these are not just any old bills. These are the bills that fund the federal government.
What about the GOP move to say we'll ban all earmarks, but just for 1 year when we don't have the majority?
Right. Yeah. The Republicans come along and sort of in a game of one-upsmanship say, we're going to ban all earmarks. And it's unclear how much of the caucus would want to do that either. You can't underestimate the power that the appropriators have, the ones who dole out the money in the appropriations committees, have over the leadership of their caucuses. So, the leadership may come in and say, we're going to do this. But it's a different story when you're talking about a whole bunch of members of Congress going home and having to prove why they're in Washington, why they've been elected to be in Washington. A lot of people back at home don't think that the earmarks that benefit their district is pork. It's, one man's pork and it's another man's public project. So, it's all up in the air. It's all speculative at this point. And it seems to be that the Democrats wanted some kind of good ethics news in a week where there has been a lot of bad ethics news for them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news from the big 9/11 settlement. The president puts off or postpones by a few days his trip to Asia. Health push goes on, a mess over Eric Massa in the Congress, and more. You can join the conversation this hour with NPR's Andrea Seabrook, George Packer from The New Yorker, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's get our listeners in right here. Matthew in Paducah, Kentucky. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I was thinking about what I heard from Supreme Court Justice John Roberts. It seems to me, I wouldn't say he has an exaggerated sense of self-importance because he's a highly important man, but he seems to have an exaggerated sense of self-majesty to think that he and the other justices can blithely go to the State of the Union address and be impervious to criticism. I mean, the State of the Union address is to discuss the State of the Union, and Supreme Court decisions are indeed part of that.
Yeah, it's a great point. George Packer, look at it. You've got a big global view and also an American view. What about the Chief Justice's kind of threat not to show up anymore at the State of the Union address? He said if it's descended into a political pep rally, of course, it's pretty much what it is pretty much what it's been for quite a while. How did you see that, George?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with the caller from Kentucky. I mean, the idea that the Supreme Court should be regarded with a kind of reverence as a sacred and secret body that is above and immune from politics, if that was ever true, and I don't think it ever has been true, it's been long since exploded, partly by the conduct of Supreme Court justices themselves. I mean, just last fall, I heard Justice Antonin Scalia give a talk in Berlin, and he was every bit as pugilistic and combative a speaker as anyone at the CPAC conference, for example, once the Q&A started.
Yeah,
and I asked him about Bush v. Gore, which to me remains the most important decision of the court in the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me in no uncertain terms, that to get over it. And it was quite a performance by Scalia. And he even carries that to the bench a little bit in taunting and mocking his co-justices. So I think Roberts, who came to the court promising to be an umpire, simply calling the balls and strikes, we already saw in that campaign finance decision that he was willing to go well beyond that role in overturning legislation. I think it's a little hard to credit him with, properly hurt sensibilities. The Supreme Court is part of our politics. They join it. They argue in it. They shape it. And so they have to be accountable to it.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Next year, are we going to see all of Congress, the First Lady up in the, up in the stands, the generals with all their regalia and empty seats where the Supreme Court used to sit?
It could be, but what a statement that would be. I mean, it's the content of that decision as much as everything. That's an affront to the elected branches. at a moment when what Louis Brandeis called our financial oligarchy, through its control of Capitol Hill, is dominating, you know, writing legislation on banks, through lobbying in the past, set up this crisis of deregulation that resulted in this dreadful recession. At this moment, when money is just flooding into the Capitol, the Supreme Court decides to say, no, it's a constraint on corporations to have them just go fund through their PACs. Let them dig into their treasuries and buy out you people.
Like any citizen.
Just like any citizen.
Unions too. Unions too.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Let them all get up there and pay. And, you know, so it was an affront to elected government. Essentially, it calls into, if elections are held under the auspices of America's big givers like that, huge givers, the already frayed legitimacy will fray even more. And you know, he could have decided that decision narrowly. That was just set up for a very narrow ruling. Instead, it was this sweeping First Amendment case. No, I think they deserve the reproof that they got.
The White House came right back. Yes, Andrea.
I have to say, I've been in the chamber for the last, 6 or 7 State of the Unions.
That's a big number.
It is really strange to sit up there in the gallery and look down and see that the only people who are glued to their seats by their own sense of fairness is the justices of the Supreme Court and perhaps the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
But isn't that as it should be? Do we want them like hooting and hollering like a congressman?
No, I don't think we do. But I think I have a little bit of understanding for why he says he feels that way. Also, let me say, in his defense, and I don't mean to only be in his defense, I think all of these arguments are really interesting and a lot of truth to them. But the way that you criticize the Supreme Court for a decision you don't like is by passing new legislation in Congress. It's not by trying to roll back on it or criticizing the decision it makes. It's
but
the
you're not
highest
likely
court
to pass
land.
A new constitution, and that's what they were citing in this decision. They were saying this
but
was fundamental.
But you can pass amendments to the we have a structure for doing that. Criticizing what the highest court, everyone should criticize, of course, but standing up there in front of them and criticizing what the highest court in the land, the decision that is made when there is, you know, there is some kind of recourse for it. I mean, what could they have done after the fact?
It was settled law, and then in their hands it
yes.
wasn't. But that
yes.
fight's going to go on. Let's go to Nashville. And Pete, you're on the air. Hello,
hey,
Pete. Are you there?
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a conservative, I guess. I've been paying attention for about 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you guys tend to miss, a lot of you do, is that the people out here in the middle of America can see what Obama's leadership is. He's all about big and bigger and bigger and bigger government, and right now is not the time for that. Health care is going to be the stake in our heart. It's going to just, if we don't start cutting the size of the federal government, states are trying to do what they can. Here in Nashville, we're doing what we can to reevaluate how our taxes are spent, and I really think that it's going to be a huge house cleaning coming up, and I hate to say it, Obama is blind to everything, and I think the Democrats are right in there with him, and it better wake up.
Pete, we got it. George Packer, what do you say? David Brooks writing this morning that people misunderstand Obama, that he may be, you know, the most reasonable guy in Washington, but he also says Obama may have misunderstood the country sentiment on when it comes to government and its size.
Yeah, I think that David Brooks's column and the caller from Nashville are saying the same thing, that Obama and Democrats in general imagine that there's an appetite for federal activism on a scale that just doesn't exist out there in the country. And I think the caller really did define what's going to be the philosophical debate in the coming election and the 2012 election, and really has been the debate ever since the Reagan presidency. And it somehow in the last few weeks or months, the philosophical core of that debate has come very clear, partly because I think both sides have really retreated to first principles. I would say in response, though, you know, Americans want a lot of things right now, and many of those things are contradictory things. They want to get the deficit down. They want government to get out of their lives. They also want jobs. And they also want health care,
right,
which didn't just come out of nowhere. It wasn't invented by Barack Obama mm-hmm. and the Democratic Congress. This has been a chronic problem and issue and desire for decades. And Obama's plan, which is being debated now in the House and Senate, if you look back at the history of health care reform, mm-hmm. is really right about in the center of various programs. It's to the right of Richard Nixon's program back in the early 70s. So our times have moved the terms of debate to the right, which I think gives conservatives an exaggerated sense of just how left-wing Barack Obama is. And I also think that the contradictory demands and desires of the electorate are every bit as important in this as the sense that the Republicans are going to win a lot of seats at the midterms.
Soul-searching for everybody to do here. I want to get Betty from Walterboro, South Carolina, if I can, for a moment. Betty, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is a great show, and I've been listening for a long time. My comment is that I just think the Democratic Party is just far away from their president. I looked at the Bush Cheney time when they were in office, and the Republican Party seemed to follow them lockstep without question in every decision, almost every decision that was made. And it seems like they were behind the scenes, may have had questions and comments, but in public, they were lockstep with the president. With this president, it's like, little boy, you just stay in that little White House and you just listen to us big boys while we take care of our business because we got the power back.
Well, Betty, we hear the heat on your pitch. It's loud and clear, and we've got it. Andrea, what about it on the merits? Betty saw lockstep GOP followership, and where is it under this Democratic president?
I think Betty is absolutely correct, and you're pointing out one of the things that makes covering Washington so interesting. The two parties are not just different ideologically, they're very different structurally. And the way that the Republican coalition stays together and gets anything done is by being in lockstep with their leaders all the time. A top-down message, everyone stays on it, and that is how they get things done. Now, in some ways, the Democratic coalition is much broader, includes many more varied ideas, and the whole sort of philosophical underpinnings of the Democratic Party is that people should all have a separate voice, and it leads to a lot of infighting, and it leads to a lot of, you know, internal discussions about how things could go. Leaks happen all the time. It's a totally different sort of culture within the Democratic Party, and it's just basic differences between the two parties. I don't think you're going to see much of a change in those two.
We'll come back home. There's a lot to talk about here, but there was a lot going on abroad in the Middle East, for starters, this week. Vice President Joe Biden in Israel looking to try and get something restarted on the peace talks front there, and then the announcement, 1,600 new units of Israeli housing going up in East Jerusalem. The Palestinians very unhappy about that. The vice president pretty unhappy about it. On Tuesday, he was with the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, assured the Israeli leader of the strong relationship between the two countries.
Progress occurs in the Middle East when everyone knows there's simply no space between the United States and Israel. There is no space between the United States and Israel when it comes to Israel's security.
No space on security, but plenty of space, sharp space, it turned out, on this housing issue and what it might mean for trying to get something going with peace talks in Israel again. The president here turning right around and saying those new housing units in East Jerusalem, a problem.
2 days ago, the Israeli government announced it would advance planning for new housing units in East Jerusalem. I realize this is a very touchy subject in Israel as well as my own country, but because that decision, in my view, undermined the trust required for productive negotiations, I, and at the request of President Obama, condemned it immediately and unequivocally.
Condemning immediately and unequivocally, George Packer, what do you see in this fracas in Israel this week?
Well, for one thing, I see a deeply embarrassed vice president. Imagine making this high-profile trip to the region to talk to both Israeli and Palestinian leaders, and the very first thing he finds out is that 1,600 new units are going to be built in East Jerusalem. Whether Netanyahu knew that the announcement was coming or not, it was a huge slap in the face of Biden. And I think beyond that, it shows how hard it has been all year and will continue to be for Obama to be a transformative figure internationally. I think his very presence in the White House and the change of tone and the Cairo speech pushed it about as far as it could go by sheer force of his personality and his thinking. And now we're back to the same problems, whether it's with the Iranian nuclear program, the eternal Israeli-Palestinian problem, which, to use the word destined again for the second time in the show, may well be destined not to be resolved. Obama and his vice president and his administration simply can't will it forward. And I think they were a bit naive last year when they imagined that the Obama magic could somehow unlock this this steel door in the Middle East.
You had the Interior Minister, Eli Yishai. He's the head of the hawkish or a member of the hawkish Shas party. He came back and said, look, we had no desire, quoting him here, no intention to offend or taunt an important man like the vice president on his trip. But even Israelis hear a commentator in Haaretz saying, why would Israeli officials degrade Israel by humiliating the vice president of the United States? Andrea, what do you see in this exchange?
I'm going to defer to my wiser partners on this. I really...
Jack?
Yes.
Well, a member of the Jerusalem City Council, I think, put it in the Palestinian perspective when he said this is... He was a member of the Jerusalem City Council. He said this was an effort to sabotage the peace talks, to kill them in their crib. And they weren't even in the crib. They were barely conceived. I mean, it was such a at-remove sort of beginning to talking about a settlement. Israel has its politics, and its foreign policy more and more is hostage to that. I mean, the experience of the last decade, the disappointment with the partners not finding a partner for peace, the Hamas problem and so on, has really driven that electorate, you could say, to the right, but just also made them just sort of, I think, despair of finding a peace. And Netanyahu exploited that. You know, there's an item in today's paper about a square in a town on the West Bank that's being named now by the Palestinian Authority for a woman who committed the largest single act of terrorism against Israel back in the 70s. And this is the kind of thing that people in Israel point to and they say, there's been no change. They don't want to deal with us.
But here's the U.S. trying to find its way through there somehow. Yes. And looking at a whole region. Let me get a call from Leslie Newton, Massachusetts. Leslie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just had a comment to make, and I just wanted to say, as a Jewish American and as a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, I'm pleased to hear Vice President Biden use a little bit of a harsher rhetoric with Netanyahu's Israel. The conversation in regards to the timing of the settlement's announcement, I hope, should switch to the content now and discuss the settlements. And while it was an embarrassment and clearly I felt a signal from the Israelis that this isn't going to go smoothly, I'd like them now to focus on the settlements. And also, I'd like it to be known that not all Jewish Americans are on the AIPAC page. We're not all pleased. There are strings attached with the huge amounts of money that we're giving to Israel. And that's it. I'll take my comment.
Leslie, we've got it. George, do you see anything moving here? I mean, there's so much on the line in this region now. It would be great to try and defuse. Jack points to the difficulties there. Where do we stand?
No, I don't see any movement at all. I mean, I've never seen it in years and years, really going back to pre-Oslo. I've never seen it at such a standstill as it is right now. And what this does and what the Israeli action does is it strengthens the hand of those in this country, and there are growing numbers of them, who want to make the argument that there should be a little space between Israel and us, and that seeing Israel's interests as almost synonymous with ours has been a national security mistake for the United States. Now, I don't take that nearly as far as Walt and Mersheimer do, but I do think their voice is only going to get stronger because of this action, and the Israelis should be worried about that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Late Honor, a racing Prius and tickle fights in the news this week. On Wednesday, 120 surviving female pilots from World War II were awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor at the Capitol. Here's pilot Deanie Parrish.
It was both a privilege and an honor to serve our country during some of the darkest days of World War II.
Toyota owner James Sykes called 911 when his Prius took off. On a California highway, he hit 94 miles an hour before the police helped him stop the car.
Okay, how fast are you going?
80.
You're going 80 miles an hour?
81.
And it's still
stuck? Yes. Yikes. And Jimmy Kimmel took on Congressman Eric Mass's bizarre confessions of gropings and tickle fights with his male aides.
So, if you're wondering why we don't have health care, it's because there's too much tickling in Congress.
Yuck, yuck. George Packer, The New Yorker, is with us. Andrea Seabrook of NPR. Jack Beattie, you can join us. Iraq's elections took place just last Sunday. Partial results coming out on Thursday. On Wednesday, Iraq's ambassador to the UN, Hamid Al-Bayati, spoke to CBS about the results he expected.
The bloc of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will have the largest number of seats in the parliament, no doubt about that. The second could be the Iraqi National Alliance, and the bloc of Dr. Adalawi could be the third. However, even with the largest number of seats, the Prime Minister need coalition with other blocs in order to have the two-third majority to approve the government.
George Packer, this is your turf. What do you see in the aftermath of the vote? What's emerging, or can we tell it yet here, George?
I think two things are emerging. And by the way, it's a little bizarre for the U.N. ambassador to be engaging in election predictions.
Yes, it is.
I see, first of all, a remarkably free and fair election. There were fewer complaints of fraud this time around than in the much smaller elections of a year ago. I was there in 2005 for the elections, which essentially amounted to an ethnic and sectarian census. Everyone voted along the lines of their own group. This time, there were coalitions across groups. The two leaders, and I don't think that the Iraqi National Alliance will be the second, that is the Shiite bloc. I think it will be Alawi's Sunni-Shia coalition. Alawi and Maliki are both presenting themselves as secular nationalist figures. And if their two blocs win the lion's share of the votes, that shows you that after years of civil war and disaster, really, in Iraq, Iraqis are tired of religious politics and want leaders who speak for all Iraqis and who are going to solve Iraq's problems.
It sounds hopeful. Is it hopeful, I think?
Well, the other half of it is that it's extremely worrying that we're now going to face weeks and months of horse trading with a weak government as a caretaker. And who knows where the sides are going to end up and how they're going to resolve the political differences. Violence has always been the first tool of resolution of political problems in Iraq, especially over the last few years. That has died down a bit, and real politics is beginning to show signs of life, but it's so fragile, and especially with the withdrawal of American combat brigades at the end of the summer, this is nail-biting time, this is the time when we will find out whether we will be leaving behind anything like a functioning, relatively democratic Iraq, or whether it's going to return to the chaos that we saw in the years after the invasion.
Andrea Seabrook, there's some now what plaudits out there for George Bush, the Newsweek cover we've mentioned before, but he shows him back on the aircraft carrier deck, mission accomplished, and with the theme that, well, look at the election in Iraq. Maybe he had something going on here. Are Republicans saying that in Washington? Do they want to talk about George Bush in Iraq?
No. Republicans are moving on from the Bush administration. It's remarkable how little talk, how little even the merest whisper there has been about Iraq in the U.S. Capitol beyond adding the cost of it to the cost that Afghanistan has cost the U.S. Treasury and sort of questioning this week in particular what that money could have been spent on here at home, as we saw the debate on Afghanistan in the House of Representatives. It's amazing to me how much the national, and at least even reflected in Washington, the attention has moved back to Afghanistan. And it's true with the military forces as well. We're seeing the first big push in Afghanistan by this administration, and a lot of Democrats and Republicans here in Capitol Hill pushing, supporting the president in that. And that's really what the talk is about if you're going to talk about war.
There was the debate in Washington this week in Congress. Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich, former presidential contender, debated, along with others, a resolution to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan, and quite soon was rejected after 3 hours of debate, 65 to 356. But I don't know if there's ever been quite this kind of debate. There's been a debate on funding, but this was on actually just the war being there, getting out. Here's Dennis Kucinich.
As U.S. armed forces and our allies begin the first in a series of large military operations in Afghanistan, this House must be heard from. We must reclaim our constitutional responsibility and our responsibility to the American people.
Texas Republican Ron Paul piled right in. This war is an illegal war, an immoral war, an unconstitutional war. We've heard him say that. But Jack, the vote is to hang in.
Yes, it is, overwhelmingly. On the other hand, I don't think the president can just blink by 60 Democrats voting with forces in the field, with some signs of success in Afghanistan, or at least a momentum of success, to have 60 Democrats say, pull them out now. I think that it's a warning about the future, I think. But you know, if I might just, Tom, to return to Iraq just for a second, I think some of the revisionism, the Newsweek cover, a Tom Friedman column this week, it's somewhat premature, it seems to me. And of course, it also has to deal with, what did Ronald Reagan say? Facts are stubborn things, and there are moral facts. According to Iraq Body Count, the website, 100,000 Iraqis have died. Civilians have died. That's documented deaths through various forms of violence, since we crashed into that country. That would be about 1 million Americans. There are strategic facts. When Saddam was there, there was a check in the Gulf against Iranian expansionism. Now, whatever happens, it looks like there's going to be a roughly pro-Iranian government there. And finally, political facts. I mean, the war here showed a kind of something that happened to our democracy that one wouldn't have thought would happen. You had the opposition party collapse. You had a capitulant press. You had the use of propaganda and fear. And you got us into a war that we didn't need to get into. So these are hard facts to reconcile with the notion of, say, mission accomplished.
Let's go to Whitingham, Vermont, and Bob. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It seems to me that the Obama administration is investing too much in trying to bring the parties together in the Middle East. In June of 2009, President Obama sent letters to the Arab leaders, largely unanswered, asking for symbolic gestures, the reopening of commercial interest offices for Israel in Oman, Qatar, Morocco, permission for Israeli commercial airlines to fly over Gulf states, shaking hands with Israeli leaders and to provide tourist visas to Israelis seeking to visit Arab countries. And it was largely unanswered. And it just seems that they will not accept the presence of Israel in the Middle East. And I just seems to me.
But Bob, there's the vice president saying, I don't have the exact words, but saying, you know, there is zero daylight between the United States and Israel on security. You know, commitment is absolute and so on. Is that not good enough? And beyond that, shouldn't the U.S. be trying to get some kind of resolution there? Or are you just saying, forget it, it won't work?
Well, you know, the peace treaty with Egypt was a high point of relations in the Arab world, and now professional Egyptians cannot really come to Israel. They're not accepted. The Egyptians do not encourage that at all. there's no evidence that they're really accepting Israel's acceptance.
Bob, we've got the perspective. George Packer, let me bring that to you, because there's so much at play from Israel right across Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan now. I mean, how, you know, we had Gates and Ahmadinejad practically side by side in Kabul, a little influence game there. And then there's Pakistan beyond with a huge bombing in Lahore. How important do you think a resolution with Israel and the Palestinians, or at least something better than we've had lately, is? Or can it just be set aside and go on and try and, you know, deal with all these things without movement there?
Yeah, I think we can't wait. And I also think we overestimate, we exaggerate the amount, the degree to which events in one country affect those in a neighboring country. For example, Iran, which Jack rightly said was kept in check by Saddam. Saddam was also a profoundly destabilizing force in the Middle East, so let's not forget that. But Iran is now in a position where the government is essentially in a low-grade war with its own people. And that has absolutely nothing to do with either Iraq or Afghanistan. Iranians pay no attention to the wars going on across either of their borders. And in, I think on Iran, we're actually in a much stronger position strategically than we were a year ago, with the rise of the Green Movement and with the obvious intransigence of Iranian leadership toward negotiations over the nuclear program. It was interesting to see Ahmadinejad and Karzai engaging in a hug in Kabul. It was a strategic hug for both men. But what I thought was, well, these two men understand each other. They're both in power because of massive fraud. One of them happens to be our partner and ally. The other happens to be our enemy. But they sort of got there by the same route, whereas in Iraq, I think a far cleaner election took place. Iraq, which has always been the problem child in the neighborhood. So what this tells me is, first of all, there is no grand strategy which is going to solve all these problems at once. Second, no one can really know the future in these places. If you had told me 3 years ago that we'd be looking at Iraq as a somewhat more hopeful place than Afghanistan, I would have thought you were crazy. And third, each country really has its own internal political dynamics that you have to spend a lot of time and patience to understand before you can know what the United States position would be. But to see them as kind of part of a mega region in which the same forces are at work everywhere and we need to go either right or left is the wrong way strategically to think about
but
it.
But there's certainly overlap. Here's Secretary Gates on the plane on the way to Afghanistan talking about Iran's role, saying Iran was interfering with its neighbor, Afghanistan.
Well, I think Iran is playing a double game in Afghanistan. They want to maintain a good relationship with the Afghan government. They also want to do everything they possibly can to hurt us.
Of course, Ahmadinejad coming back in Kabul saying to the U.S., your country's halfway around the world. Why are you here? Pete, Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Pete.
Hi.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, I'll just answer Andrew's question from earlier. If we weren't in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, we could have put a big dent in the health care debate. I would say that Israel is doing the same thing that they've always done to the U.S., is they go ahead and do as they please after even before we leave.
So it sounds like kind of the Kucinich perspective that you've got there, Pete. Spend some of that money at home.
And then I think even saving all the money on the war, we could have stopped the stimulus, and I would encourage all our officials to vote for a public option or nothing at all.
Pete, thanks very much for your call. I want to turn to the back and forth, interesting back and forth this week between Liz Cheney and her group, Keep America Safe, and some pretty prominent conservative legal scholars over whether it was right that some Justice Department officials now had earlier been involved in defense of 9/11 and other terror cases. Here's a web ad released by Liz Cheney's group, Keep America Safe, and it went after Attorney General Eric Holder and the Justice Department for hiring attorneys who once defended terrorism detainees.
So who did President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder hire? Nine lawyers who represented or advocated for terrorist detainees. Who are these government officials? Eric Holder will only name two. Why the secrecy behind the other seven? Whose values do they share? Tell Eric Holder, Americans have a right to know the identity of the Al-Qaeda Seven.
Ooga booga, who's defending what folks here? But she got very strong pushback. It was interesting from a bunch of conservative legal scholars, including Kenneth Starr, the former independent counsel. Here he is on MSNBC on Monday, heavily criticizing Liz Cheney and Keep America Safe for their attack on lawyers who had once represented terrorism detainees.
Lawyers have an ethical obligation, to be willing to take on unpopular causes. That is an obligation that goes with the profession. It goes with the territory. So one needs to be courageous at times and to be willing to stand up to power and to say, look, I'm going to make the best arguments that I can as a zealous advocate on behalf of this particular client. So lawyers who did that with respect to the detainees were acting in these very fine traditions. They knew it was going to be controversial. But they deserve commendation. They do not deserve criticism at all.
Andrea Seabrook, an interesting debate within kind of the conservative neck of the woods over Liz Cheney's throwing stones at these attorneys.
Well, you know, I really think this is going to sound a little bit, I hope this isn't a forced thing, but it reminds me of the question of Chief Justice John Roberts being at the State of the Union address. I mean, it's sort of an interesting question of the responsibility of somebody who is in the bar or on the bench to uphold the principles that they see in the law with a capital L over politics. And I think that's why, you know, I sort of have some sympathy for the argument of Chief Justice John Roberts. Of course, he shouldn't be hooting and hollering, but maybe he shouldn't be there at all in that case. And the same thing is inherent in the argument about the Justice Department lawyers, that saying that somebody defended someone who is accused of a terrible crime mm-hmm. against the United States is somehow tarnished with that brush.
With their crimes, the Al Qaeda 7.
Right. Yeah, it really goes against what the whole purpose of the law is.
The United States Constitution, to name one package
yes.
of law. Yeah, there it is. Right to representation, but not in Liz Cheney's world, maybe. But in Ken Starr's, on the conservative end of the spectrum. Interesting hour, interesting subjects this week. I'm very grateful to each of you for being here. Andrea Seabrook, congressional correspondent for National Public Radio in Washington. Thank you for joining us, Andrea.
My pleasure.
George Packer, staff writer at The New Yorker, author of the big article in this week's edition, Obama's Lost Year. George, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Tom.
Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.